So let me just remind you of the, if you like, the plot outline of Job as it's presented to us. Job is a wealthy man, a righteous man. He's challenged by an opponent, and through the course of that challenge loses everything, including his health. Three friends come to him, and the bulk of the book is about the following debate. The three friends say, "You must have done something evil for this to come upon you. Repent, and God will fix everything." And Job's response to this again and again was, "I have not departed from God's ways, and if God would just listen to me, I would prove that to him." And so this debate goes backwards and forwards, and it intensifies and so on. At the end of that debate, they're joined by Elihu, and various opinions are expressed by Elihu. I'm convinced that Elihu is there as a messenger from God and is answering Job on God's behalf, and we'll later on in the study talk about this from structural reasons, why he's there on God's behalf. And moreover, not only does he address the issues that Job has been raising on God's behalf, but he announces the arrival of God himself, and God comes to them in a whirling storm and challenges Job to re-examine his perspective. Job repents, and God condemns the three friends and restores Job. So that, I'm sure, we're all familiar with as the general sweep of the book. Now let's go into some detail. This first talk is styled "In the Land of Uz," and what I want to do is just try to lay the framework, lay the groundwork for when the context of the book should be understood. Some people will suggest that Job is the oldest book in Scripture. I suggest perhaps not. It seems to me, and I'll give you the evidence for this, that the events in Job occur at the same time as the Exodus. So I will argue from a number of points of view that when Job and the three friends are having their debate, it's exactly the same time that the children of Israel are there in the wilderness. Now, why do people say that the book is very old? Well, there's a number of reasons here. First of all, and I should say I'm no Hebrew scholar, Hebrew here is very ancient, especially in the speeches. I did a little Hebrew at university, but I found out that I couldn't both invent the necessary mathematics for my PhD and learn Hebrew vocabulary at the same time, so I had to give up on the Hebrew course. But nonetheless, there's a lot of consistent evidence seems to be that the Hebrew in these speeches particularly is very ancient. And you see this in the use of the various names of God, that the name Yahweh is almost never used in the book of Job. In fact, it's almost never used in the speeches. The times it does arise are in the narrative sections at the start and at the end. It's as if somebody with a slightly different perspective was giving us the context of these ancient speeches. Perhaps the narrative was written sometime after the speeches themselves. There's another couple of pieces of evidence. If you come to Job, and I ask not to have a reading here because we're going to be looking at many scriptures this morning. Job 42, there's an interesting use of a name of a coin here. Job 42 and verse 11. This is after Job's restoration. It says, "All his brothers and sisters and everyone who had known him before came and ate with him in his house. They comforted and consoled him over all the trouble the Lord had brought upon him, and each one gave him a piece of silver and a gold ring." In my NIV footnote on "piece of silver," I have that it's the word kesita. He gave him a kesita. And I don't know how coins are named in South Africa. They're not in England, but in America we have coins. We have a nickel, we have a dime, and the coin itself has a name, and so, you know, such is the name that I think even the dime doesn't actually have its value on there. It just has the word "a dime," and you just have to know how much a dime is worth. It doesn't say that it's 10 cents. So there's this coin called a kesita, which is mentioned elsewhere in Scripture. In Joshua chapter 24 and verse 32. Joshua 24 and verse 32. Let me just read that to you. This is Joshua talking about the summary at the end of Joshua, verse 32 of Joshua 24. And Joseph's bones, which the Israelites had brought up from Egypt, were buried at Shechem in the tract of land that Jacob bought for 100 kesita, exactly the same word, 100 kesita, from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem. This became the inheritance of Joseph's descendants. So there was a coin around in Jacob's time. Jacob had used it, and now that same coin is around in Job's time. So this certainly tells us that we should think of Job being an old book. It pushes back our expectation of how old Job, the book of Job is. There's other factors as well. For example, after his restoration, Job lives 140 years. And that raises an interesting thought that perhaps altogether he may have lived 210 years. Almost everything seems to be doubled after his restoration from what it was before. So perhaps he had lived 70 years before. That's a guess, supposition, but reasonable. He may have lived 70 years up to the time of the trials of this book, and then 140 years afterwards. And so that makes him 210. And again, old ages like that, we tend to think earlier in Genesis. So those are some of the things that push the book back, that tell us we should think of it early. But I think there are some very powerful things that tell us that we shouldn't push it back too early. And I think one of the interesting ones is found in Genesis chapter 36 and verse 11. Genesis 36, verse 11. This is the account of Esau, verse 9, the father of the Edomites in the hill country of Seir. Verse 10, these are the names of Esau's sons: Eliphaz, the son of Esau's wife Ada, and Reuel, the son of Esau's wife Basemath. Verse 11, the sons of Eliphaz are Teman, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, and Kenaz. So what we have here is Esau, who was obviously Isaac's son, Abraham, Isaac, Esau. We have Esau has a son called Eliphaz. Eliphaz has a son called Teman. Now, by chasing some other scriptures around, and we'll look at one of them in a minute, Teman established a clan, and that clan was called the Temanites. And so in this clan of the Temanites, who lived on the east of the Jordan in the land of Edom, in this clan of the Temanites, there is a son born, a child born, who, well, it would not be surprising to find that son was named after the father of the clan head, namely after Eliphaz. And so we have Eliphaz the Temanite. So we have Abraham, Isaac, Esau, Eliphaz, Teman, and then somewhere way down, after a few generations perhaps, another Eliphaz. And so that is very powerful, it seems to me, that we're talking, when we're introduced to one of the friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, that is telling us that it's at least five generations after Abraham. You simply can't make it less than five generations. Teman himself, that led to the Temanite clan, was four generations after Abraham, and so it was within that clan, and we don't know how long within that clan, that Eliphaz the Temanite came along. Look with me, if you would, just to Jeremiah 49 and verse 7, and you'll see a reference to this. Jeremiah 49 and verse 7. This is tying up Esau and Teman as a land. Concerning Edom, this is what the Lord Almighty says: is there no longer wisdom in Teman? Has counsel perished from the prudent? Has their wisdom decayed? And so we have this land or this area described as Teman, named after Teman, the grandson of Esau. And it's in the land of Edom, in Esau's land. So I think references like this establish quite firmly that there is this tribe on the east of the Jordan called the Temanites. And Eliphaz the Temanite is one from that tribe. And as I say, we don't know how early in the history of that tribe Eliphaz arises, but nonetheless, it's at least five generations after Abraham, and maybe more like 10 generations. So at the very least, 5 generations after Abraham puts Israel down in the land of Egypt. At the very least, because 5 generations after Abraham is the same as Manasseh and Ephraim, Joseph's sons. They also were 5 generations from Abraham. So at the very least, Israel is in Egypt. And I'm going to give what I believe is strong evidence that in fact Israel has come out of Egypt. Some of the other friends are harder to place. Bildad the Shuhite, it's quite hard to be sure, but the nearest that the commentators seem to come up with is it ties in with Genesis 25 and verse 2. And I'll mention this not because of the solidity of this particular reference, but because we'll come back to this passage a lot in Genesis 25. If I said to you, how many children did Abraham have? Your immediate thought, if you're anything like me, is one. Oh no, two. And of course, all of that is completely wrong. I can never remember how many children he had. But through Keturah, of course, he had many more children. So verse 1 of Genesis 25, Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah. She bore him Zimram, Joksham, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua. And the suggestion that a number of people have made is that the tribe of Shuites is named after Shua, this son of Abraham. And so again, that would place Bildad, if this happens to be correct, this would place Bildad after Abraham. There's a fascinating thing about these sons in verse 5 and 6. Abraham left everything he owned to Isaac. That is, Isaac became the sole heir. But, verse 6, while he was still living, Abraham gave gifts to the sons of his concubines and sent them away from his son Isaac to the land of the east. So we know from this that Shua and the other children were sent to the land of the east. People like Midian and so on. Children of Abraham sent to the land of the east, given gifts in order to be able to be established. Well, the events of Job take place in the land of Uz, and there are actually two reasonable references to that in Genesis. One which I think is not the correct one, and I'll give you the reasons, is in Genesis 10. I think in Genesis 22 we actually have the Uz that is being referred to. Genesis 22 and verse 21. We'll go in a context for verse 20. Sometime later, Abraham was told, Milcah is also a mother. She has borne sons to your brother Nahor. Uz, the firstborn, Buz, his brother, Kemuel, the father of Aram, and so on and so on. So we have Uz here as being a child of Nahor. That is, Uz would be about the same level as Isaac. If you think of Abraham and Nahor being around the same, then you get Uz and Buz and Isaac being at the same level. So why this Uz rather than the one in Genesis 10? Well, I think one of the powerful things is because Buz also is mentioned. If we look in Job 32, verse 2, we'll find that in the land of Uz, where the events are taking place, we have a man called Elihu, verse 2 of Job 32, who is a son of Barachel, the Buzite. And so we have a Buzite living there or being there in the land of Uz. And so we've got Uz and Buz together. It seems quite reasonable that we're talking about this pair of Uz and Buz rather than trying to tie it in with Genesis 10. There's other connections. Let's just look at a couple of other scriptures just to make the point. Lamentations chapter 4 and verse 21. I was about to apologize for sending you all over scripture, but I have no apologies here. And if you wish simply to listen, then that's fine as well. But we'll turn them up. Lamentations 4 verse 21. Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom. And Edom, recall, is Esau. Say it's the alternative name for Esau. So it's the group that went out to live in the land of the east as well. Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom, you who live in the land of Uz. To you also the cup will be passed, you'll be drunk and stripped naked. So the land of Uz being tied there in with where Edom was living. One more, Jeremiah 25 and verse 20. Jeremiah 25 and verse 20. The context is verse 17. I took the cup from the Lord's hand and made all the nations to whom he sent me to drink it. Verse 19, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, his attendants, his officials, and all his people. Verse 20, and all the foreign people there, all the kings of Uz, all the kings of the Philistines, those of Ashkelon, Gaza, Ekron, and the people left at Ashdod, Edom, Moab, Ammon, all the kings of Tyre. And if we jump down just a couple of verses to 23, Dedan, Tema, Buz, and all those who are in distant places. So again, there's not only the land of Uz, but there's also the land of Buz listed in the same group. So it seems to me that there's enough evidence there to suggest that we should view this as a single whole, and we're talking about the Uz and the Buz, and the land of Uz being named after Nahor's son, Uz, not being any earlier. So the conclusion at this point would be simply that we have to look at the events of Job taking place about 5 to 10 generations after Abraham, which would put it somewhere in the range of at least Israel is down in Egypt, or they may be coming up out of Egypt, probably not established in the land. It would be surprising that there's no reference in the book of Job to Israel being established in the land. So I think that it's quite reasonable to suggest it hasn't gone that far. They're certainly east of the Jordan River, in what we call the land of Jordan today. They're north of Edom, they're to the north of Eden, maybe up around Damascus, somewhere around there perhaps, or maybe even into Syria. So that's what we've got so far, but I think there's a line of evidence that is tremendously powerful that doesn't come across at all well in the King James Version, but is really picked up rather nicely in the New International Version. And again here, I have to apologize for my lack of Hebrew, and Brother Barry no doubt will set me straight if I stray here. There's a name that occurs in the Bible, the name Rahab. Now actually, Rahab occurs in two different places. There's Rahab the harlot. That's actually a mistransliteration. If we were consistent in taking her name from the Hebrew, we should call her Rachab or Rahab. It's a CH there. So I'm not talking about her at all. That's a completely different name. I'm talking about a different Rahab that occurs 6 times in the Old Testament. And I'd like us to look at all 6 of them. And we'll start in Psalm 87 and verse 4. This is one of those stunning psalms, looking at the record of the peoples. This one was born in Zion. Verse 4 of Psalm 87, the NIV has, I will record Rahab and Babylon among those who acknowledge me. And the NIV has a footnote there saying, Rahab is a poetic name for Egypt. And indeed that would make sense here. If you look at this verse, I will record Rahab and Babylon among those who acknowledge me, Philistia too, and Tyre along with Cush, and will say this one was born in Zion. So there's a whole bunch of places. There's Rahab, there's Babylon, there's Philistia, there's Tyre, and there's Cush. I forget, does this one, how does the King James have this one? Is it Rahab? It is as Rahab. It's the name. Sorry? And the Revised has translated it, has interpreted it to be Egypt. So that word Rahab has come through as a name there consistently in all the translations. Jump to a couple of psalms, to Psalm 89 and verse 10. exactly the same word in Hebrew. As I say, this word only occurs six times. Verse 9 for context. You rule over the surging sea. When its waves mount up, you still them. You crushed Rahab like one of the slain. With your strong arm, you scattered your enemies. What does the King James have there? It's something like you crushed the proud, maybe? Oh, it's still got Rahab there at that point. Okay, maybe it's in Isaiah it gets translated. So it's still Rahab. So what's this talking about? You rule over the surging sea. When its waves mount up, you still them. You crushed Rahab like one of the slain. With your strong arm, you scattered your enemies. Well, it's not hard to figure out what it's talking about. It's talking about the children of Israel coming out and the power of Egypt being destroyed in the Red Sea. And Isaiah makes this even more clear if we come over to a couple of references there. Isaiah chapter 30 and verse 7. This is the people of Israel are thinking of taking some help, taking some support by going down to Egypt. Isaiah is saying at the start of the chapter, "Woe to the obstinate children, to those who carry out plans that are not mine," and so on. Verse 2, "who go down to Egypt." Verse 6, "an oracle concerning the animals of the Negev, through a land of hardship and distress, of lions and lionesses, of adders and darting snakes. The envoys carry their riches on donkeys' backs, their treasures on humps of camels, to that unprofitable nation, to Egypt, whose help is utterly useless. Therefore I call her Rahab the do-nothing." Rahab the useless. She's useless. She's not going to help you at all. You're going down to this nation, and I call her Rahab the do-nothing. Useless Rahab is her name. Isaiah chapter 51 and verse 9. So we've now had half of the references. This is the fourth reference that we have in the Old Testament. Verse 9 of Isaiah 51. "Awake, awake, clothe yourself with strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in days gone by, as in generations of old. Was it not you who cut Rahab to pieces, who pierced that monster through? Was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made a road in the depths of the sea so that the redeemed might cross over?" Now, is it this one that the King James translates? The previous one. Oh, the previous one. Okay. They talked about the useless, prideful nation or something, the previous one. Okay. Pardon me? Okay. And now this one, it's come through as Rahab. Is it called Rahab in the King James? So again, very clear. "Was it not you who cut Rahab to pieces, who pierced that monster through, dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, made a road in the depths of the sea so that the redeemed might cross over?" We know what it's talking about. There's no doubt what Isaiah has in mind here. He's talking about the children of Israel coming out of Egypt. So this is 4 out of 6. Okay? This word occurs 6 times. This name occurs 6 times in Scripture. And we've seen 4 of them and consistently seen that they refer to Egypt. And it's used particularly in the destruction of Egypt as Israel comes out of the Red Sea. Now, I'm sure the punchline will not have escaped you, that the other two are in Job and are used in exactly the same context. Job chapter 9 and verse 13. This is Job speaking. Verse 12 for context. "If God snatches away, who can stop him? Who can say to him, what are you doing?" Verse 13. "God does not restrain his anger. Even the cohorts of Rahab cowered at his feet." It comes out very clearly in the NIV. "Even the cohorts of Rahab cowered at his feet." It's the same name, Rahab. It's saying, even the cohorts of Egypt cowered at his feet. Job knows about this. He's mentioning it. And lest you say, well, it's a little too much just from that one reference, look at Job 26 and verse 12. and you'll see something that feels just like that passage in Isaiah. Just feels like Isaiah 51. Job 26 and verse 12. Again, this is Job speaking. By his power, God churned up the sea. By his wisdom, he cut Rahab to pieces. By his breath, the skies became fair. His hand pierced the gliding serpent. And these are but the outer fringe of his works. It sounds just like Isaiah. By his power, he churned up the sea. By his wisdom, he cut Rahab to pieces. By his breath, the skies became fair. His hand pierced the gliding serpent. So I find it inescapable that Job knows about the destruction of Egypt in the Red Sea. He uses the same language that the psalmists do. He uses the same language that Isaiah does in talking about that particular event. He uses the same, if you like, symbolic or prophetic name for Egypt. This name Rahab, which has all sorts of connotations about pridefulness. It's a name that's obtained from the word pride. And so it's this prideful nation, this Rahab, that God brought low, and these are but the outer fringe of his works. And we start to say, well, how would Job know about it? Well, of course, you remember that when the Israelites came up to Jericho, there was great fear, because the people had all heard about what had happened in Egypt, and they knew the power of God that was with these people. And so that message had certainly spread throughout the whole land. If it had spread to Jericho on the west of the Jordan, there's no reason why it shouldn't have spread to the land of Edom and up on the east of the Jordan as well. So I think what we end up concluding then is that we're more like 10 generations from Abraham rather than just 5. And it's the time that the children of Israel are coming up out of Egypt. And it's a fascinating time for the covenant of God and the relationship with God, because here he is, he's got this people that is set apart for himself, that he's bringing up out of Egypt, that has had 250 years down there in the land of sin, that is being pulled up out of the wilderness, but he has not left himself without a remnant in the other nations. And I think it's very important for us to realize the vitality of what we might call the Eastern Ecclesia at this point. You've got the children of Israel, and we tend to think completely Israel-centric. We think that the children of Israel were the only ones who remembered about Abraham and Abraham's God. But of course, it doesn't take much thinking to realize that's not true at all. Let's go back to that passage in Genesis 25. And verse 5 and 6. We looked at it already. Abraham had many children, we just said. And we find these children, verse 6, he gave, while Abraham was still living, he gave gifts to the sons of his concubines and sent them away from his son Isaac to the land of the east. So Abraham, wealthy man, in the land that he's been told to look north, south, east and west, this is the land that's going to be given to Israel. And now he says, I have all these other children, I'm going to set them up for life, I'm going to send them east across the Jordan where they can establish themselves. What do these other children believe in? Are they idolaters? Do they believe in the God of Abraham or not? Well, fortunately, we don't have to guess here. Because God gives us confidence in chapter 18 of Genesis. Remember when the three men, two of which were angels, one of which was a manifestation of Yahweh, when these three men come to Abraham, we find a discussion concerning this matter. Verse 17, then Yahweh said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Verse 18 of Genesis 18. Abraham will surely become a great and powerful nation, and all nations on earth will be blessed through him. For I have chosen him so that he will direct his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just, so that the Lord will bring about for Abraham what he has promised him. He's going to teach his children about the way of the Lord. Not, he's going to just make sure that Isaac knows about it. Abraham was a man who taught everybody in his household. Eliezer, his servant, not even related to him, knows about the God of Abraham. And when he goes off to get a wife for Isaac, he's praying to the God of Abraham. And so it's completely reasonable to assume that all of those children who are sent to the land of the east also know about the God of Abraham. They know the covenants that have been given to Abraham. They know the promises. And indeed, God himself has confidence that Abraham will direct his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord. And so what we have is this whole group of children who have been set up by Abraham with sufficient resources to establish themselves in the land of the east. And they go across and they are following the covenant of Abraham. They know about God. They know about how to serve God. And it's not, of course, just those children, but even Nahor, Abraham's brother, who stayed in the north and in the east, he also worshipped God. And that's why the children were sent up to Nahor's family to take a wife from the families that worship God. And so it's not only Isaac and Jacob and Jacob's 12 sons and the families that grow about them. They're not the only people who are worshipping the God of Abraham at this time. There are many people scattered around this land that are worshipping it. And so that gives a tremendous background for Exodus 18. You'll remember when Moses marries into the family of Jethro, priest of Midian. And I remember lots of debates when I was young as to what kind of priest was he. Well, I think it's blindingly obvious what kind of priest he was. He was a priest of God. He was one of the family of the descendants of Abraham. He is a descendant of Abraham. He knows about worshipping our God. And so you find chapter 18 and verse 12, "Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offerings and other sacrifices to God. And Abraham came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law in the presence of God." And so here's somebody not from Jacob's family. He's from Midian's family. But nonetheless, he is a true priest of God. And Moses knows to have fellowship with him. Here is a fellow believer. Here is a priest who is able to offer sacrifices in the style that they always used to offer them in the period of the Genesis. There were sacrifices, of course, long before the law of Moses came around. There's then that fascinating reference in Exodus chapter 4. I wonder whether we do Zipporah a great injustice when we understand this verse. Exodus chapter 4, I'm sure you'll remember the circumstance. Moses is going to Egypt to confront the Pharaoh of Egypt with, you need to allow us to worship our God. And God confronts Moses and says, hadn't you better get your own house in order before you actually go and tell Pharaoh what to do? And so we read that at a lodging place on the way, this is verse 24 of Exodus 4, "The Lord met Moses and was about to kill him. But Zipporah took a flint knife, cut off her son's foreskin, and touched Moses' feet with it. 'Surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me,' she said. So the Lord let him alone." At that time she said, "bridegroom of blood," referring to circumcision. And the way we normally, or our community has normally interpreted this, is that Moses had wanted to circumcise his son, but Zipporah hadn't liked the idea at all. And so Moses had gone along with it, and then finally God confronts Moses, and so Zipporah reluctantly does it and moans at Moses, you're a bridegroom of blood. Here's another way, and I'm not saying that this is necessarily right, it's just an alternative suggestion. How much of the Abrahamic covenant and the knowledge of the Abrahamic covenant do you suppose had been lost by the people of Israel being down in Egypt? Well, as soon as I ask the question that way, you'll think, well, a lot. I mean, look at the people that came out. Most of them had forgotten God completely. Most of them didn't know properly how to respond to God. And yet, on the other hand, at the same time, we have people like Job, we have people like Jethro, we have Jethro's son, Hobab, who clearly is a righteous man. You might almost argue that the Israelites need re-educating in the way of God more than these other people did. And perhaps that was the purpose of the law of Moses, not only to re-educate them, but then to take them to the next level. And so, what about Moses at this point? Had he himself, and this is almost a radical suggestion, had he himself sort of lost track of the importance of circumcision? You see, it doesn't say that Moses told Zipporah to do it. What it says is that Zipporah took a flint and did it. It seems as though Zipporah is the one who realized what needed to be done. And she went and did it. And told Moses, look, you know, you're a bridegroom of blood to me. Anyway, whether that's correct or not, I think it's equally plausible to the way we traditionally interpret those verses. I'd like to just mention one other passage here in Deuteronomy chapter 2. Deuteronomy chapter 2 and verse 4. Context, verse 2. Then the Lord said to me, you have made your way around this hill country long enough, now turn north. Now verse 4 of Deuteronomy 2. Give the people these orders. You're about to pass through the territory of your brothers, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir. They will be afraid of you, but be very careful. Do not provoke them to war, for I will not give you any of their land, not even enough to put your foot on. I have given Esau the hill country of Seir as his own. You are to pay them in silver for the food you eat and the water you drink. Look at verse 9. Then the Lord said to me, do not harass the Moabites or provoke them to war, for I will not give you any part of their land. I have given Ar to the descendants of Lot as a possession. These people, says God, are your brothers. Don't attack them. Don't think that I'm giving you their land. They are your brothers. And I think it's not only their brothers in the flesh. We've already seen that in Midian there was faith. There was Jethro the Midianite. There was his children as well. Faithful people in these nations. And we don't know how much faith actually pervaded these nations at this point. And God is saying, these are your brothers, not merely in the flesh, but they also, many of them, worship me. I mean, it's an interesting question to ask how long that lasted. How long was it before idolatry started to get involved in those nations and they finally turned away? I mean, it's clear that those kinds of forces were already at work at this point. And I think what we have to see in those nations is a kind of difficult tension between those who are worshipping God and those who are moving away to worship idols. But I think the picture that we get overall is very clear. There was a very active ecclesia of the East, of people who knew about the covenant of God through Abraham, many of whom were descended from Abraham. They worshipped God in accordance with the way that Abraham worshipped God, and they carried out the covenant work that God had established through Abraham. They were not part of Israel, but that did not make them condemned in God's eyes. They were nonetheless his children. And so when we come back to Job chapter 1, we find that here, and again I'll be definitive, and you can take me to task later on, I believe here in chapter 1 and verse 6, we have a meeting of the Eastern Ecclesia. Or perhaps the Eastern Ecclesia, maybe in the region of Pella or somewhere around there, particular area. So the NIV is terrible here, because it, instead of translating, it interprets. The NIV reads in verse 6, one day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord. the King James, of course, is correct here. One day the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. So what of this phrase, sons of God? I'd like to run through a whole bunch of references just quickly, and if you want to just listen to them as they come past, feel free, or if you want to turn them up to check that I'm not cheating, feel free to do that also. Psalm 82 and verse 1. God presides in the great assembly. He gives judgment among the, quote, gods, as the NIV. The gods are the ones in the great assembly. Psalm 82 and verse 6. I said, you are gods, you are all sons of the Most High, but you will die like mere men, you will fall like every other ruler. And you'll remember that Jesus quotes this. And so he's saying, he called them gods, and they were sons of God that are there in the assembly. And so the sons of God are those that meet together in the assembly. You'll remember, of course, Genesis 6, around the time of Noah, when it talks about the sons of God going into the daughters of men. And we argue correctly that this is not talking about heavenly powers, angels who fancied the look of earthly women. It's not talking about that kind of thing at all. It's talking about the righteous line. Those who worship God, the sons of God, started to look around at the world and see the delights of the world and the women within the world. Isaiah chapter 43 and verse 6. Let me read that to you. I will say to the north, give them up, and to the south, do not hold them back. Bring my sons from afar, and my daughters from the ends of the earth. My sons, says God, the sons of God, the daughters of God, bring them back from the north and the south. And the New Testament, if you think of the phrase in the New Testament, sons of God, what's it talking about? Is it talking about angels? No, it's used so many times we can scarcely turn them up. Talks about sons of God, meaning people like us. We think of ourselves as children of God. We are sons and daughters of God. And so it's used consistently of the saints. And so we'd have to have very strong evidence, I think, to suggest that here in Job, when it talks about the sons of God, that it's meaning anything other than believers, anything other than the righteous people that turn to God. Well, you might say, what about Job 38 and verse 7? Which is perhaps the one difficult passage from the point of view of what I was saying. Job 38 and verse 7, and it's again the phrase, sons of God. This is God speaking to Job out of the whirlwind, and he talks about, verse 4, where were you when I laid the foundations? Tell me if you understand, and so on. Verse 6, on what were its footing set, or who laid its cornerstone? Verse 7, while the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. And so God is saying, where were you when I created the earth? When all the sons of God shouted for joy? And so, you know, has that completely destroyed the argument? Well, maybe. But there's another way, I think, of looking at the whole of the Genesis passage. I don't want to get into it in great detail, but I struggled for a long time with the apparent literality of the days, and yet the evidence that we seem to have that the earth is truly ancient. What I'm of the opinion now, and I'd be happy to debate this afterwards, that the 7 days we have in Genesis are 7 days of revelation, 7 days of vision, where God showed whoever it was that wrote it down. I don't know who wrote down Genesis 1. Maybe it was Adam, maybe it was Enoch, maybe Noah, maybe Moses or Abraham, or whoever it was. God showed perhaps a group of believers the vision of him creating the heavens and the earth. And on the first day, there was light and a separation of light and darkness. And that was all that happened on that day. And then on the second day of vision, there was the separation of the waters and so on. And so in that sense, that group of truly privileged believers who saw that vision of the creation unfolding would shout for joy. And maybe this, therefore, is exactly the same kind of people. It's the righteous line. It's those who worship God to whom he reveals his work. So I'm pretty comfortable, I would say, that we're talking here simply about believers on earth who meet together in the Eastern Ecclesia and worship together. They present themselves before the Lord, verse 6, and that idea of presenting themselves before the Lord, let me just take you to one other reference. There's lots of references we could have for this phrase, but back in Joshua 24 again. Joshua 24, and we'll find exactly the same phrase used very much of human people, of human individuals. Joshua 24 and verse 1. Then Joshua assembled all the tribes of Israel at Shechem. He summoned the elders, leaders, judges, and officials of Israel, and they presented themselves before God. It's exactly the same. They presented themselves before God. And we often think about that when we come together and we talk about God being here among us. We present ourselves before God. It's not a casual thing when we come together. Now, in what form was, you know, was there a representative of God here? Was there perhaps a priest through who was inspired to speak for the Lord? I don't know. But there's a sense in which they present themselves before the Lord, and God is very present there amongst them. And it seems to me that this same idea is happening here in the Eastern Ecclesia. And so we have a picture of believers meeting in worship and with the Lord participating. And in this ecclesial setting, Satan, and I think here we are correct to translate it, the enemy, the accuser, an accuser, also came with them. And the Lord said to the accuser, "Where have you come from?" I think we're correct to translate it here, because it's purely the meaning of the word that's important here. When we get it in the New Testament, and it uses the Hebrew word in the Greek language, I think there we have to think of it as a name and understand the connotations of it pulling from the Old Testament. But here, this idea of David using this word Satan just in a completely everyday context. Well, if anything of David's life could be called everyday. But here we are in 2 Samuel 19 and verse 22. Context is verse 21, when Abishai, son of Zeruiah, said, "Shouldn't Shimei be put to death for this? He cursed the Lord's anointed." David replied, "What do you and I have in common, you sons of Zeruiah? This day you have become my Satans. Should anyone be put to death in Israel today?" You've become my Satans. You've become my adversaries. You've become my enemies. That's all he means. And the NIV correctly translates it here. And so we should translate it, I believe, here in Genesis. "And an enemy came with them. The Lord said to the enemy, 'Where have you come from?' The enemy replied to the Lord," and so on, from roaming to and fro on the earth. And so what we have is a meeting of the ecclesia, and there's one in the ecclesia who is not a true brother, who is an enemy of those that are truly trying to worship God. We actually see exactly the same thing in the New Testament church. Paul talks about being in danger from false brothers. This idea of individuals in the first century church whose purpose was political. It was to subvert true worship of God. It was to lead them back to Judaism. And it wasn't there to acknowledge Christ as Lord at all. And so we find this adversary, this false brother, here in the first century church. And you might say, well, what of the issue of Satan's power? Because in chapter 1 and verse 12, the Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, everything he has in your hands, but on the man himself do not lay a finger." And in chapter 2 and verse 6, similar, the Lord said to the adversary, "Very well then, he is in your hands, but you must spare his life." How was it that Job was in the hands of a brother in the ecclesia? What does that mean? Well, first of all, we have to be absolutely clear that the things that came upon Job came upon him from the Lord. There's no doubt about that from the very book of Job. Look at verse 3 of chapter 2 just for one of them. We'll actually look at just a couple just to show that this is without doubt. Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil, and he still maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason." Or verse 10 of the same chapter, Job, talking to his wife, says, "You're talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" Let's just look at a couple of others. Job himself in chapter 9 and verse 34 knows that this is all coming from God. The context is verse 33. "If only there were someone to arbitrate between us, to lay his hand upon us both." Verse 34 of Job 9, "Someone to remove God's rod from me so that his terror would frighten me no more." We'll just look at two others. Chapter 13 and verse 21. Context for verse 20, "Only grant me these two things, O God, and then I will not hide from you. Withdraw your hand far from me, and stop frightening me with your terrors." And finally, the verse that we already read at the end of the book in chapter 42, let me just read it to you again. The brothers and sisters coming to him, they comforted and consoled him over all the trouble the Lord had brought upon him. So it all comes from God, even though Job has been put in the power of the brother. So what's going on? Seems to me that God is saying to this individual, "I will fulfill your prayer. If you ask for blessing, I will bless. If you ask for cursing, I will curse." It's rather like the someone wanted to be in on Israel. He wanted to go to Israel, and he wanted to curse Israel and have God bring all sorts of judgments and condemnations upon Israel. And in that case, God said to Balaam, "No, Israel is not in your power. You may not say these things. I will tell you what to say." But this is a different situation. In this situation, Job has been placed in the power of his enemy. I think there's a rather scary exhortation here for us. If we say the only reason that Brother X follows God is because he's rich, he's blessed in this way or that way, then God might say, "Well, let us see. Well, what do you want to happen to Brother X? And maybe our grumblings get worked out in the life of Brother X." I mean, it's a scary thought that at least once in history we have had the situation where a righteous servant of God is placed in the power of an unrighteous pseudo-servant of God, and that unrighteous servant is able to bring all sorts of dreadful things upon that righteous servant. It means that we have to think very carefully about what we want for our brothers and sisters. Do we look at them with envy and say the only reason they follow God is because God is taking such care of them? Or do we look at them and see, well, God is taking care of them, but I see a real depth of spirit in that individual, and I wish I could live up to it. See, that's what God is challenging Satan with. He's saying, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright, a man who fears God." And I think what the Lord is saying here, and as I say, it may be through the mouth of a priest or somebody who's acting for the Lord here, he's taking this brother aside and saying, "There are problems in your life, brother. You ought to look carefully at Job. You ought to see what sort of person he is, and you ought to emulate him in your life. You ought to see him as an example to follow. He's a very rich and powerful example, one that you could learn a lot by." And instead of saying, I take the exhortation and I will learn, the adversary says, there's no depth to Job at all. The only reason that he serves God is because God has hedged him around. So I see that my time has gone. All we've been able to do, as I say, is just lay a broad framework. What we hope to do in the next few sessions is actually look at the sweep of the book and how the arguments develop. Try to get a sense of what the different individuals are like. Where are they coming from? What's the perspective that they're bringing to this? and then we'll look at how both Elihu and Job and God, I guess that's not both, is it? What do you talk when there's three of them? All three of Elihu, Job and God, how they address the whole situation and what we should learn by their insights. So we'll leave it for there. Thank you very much.